from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, make it a quickie. That's the slogan for the San Francisco Water Agency's new ad campaign promoting shorter showers, a response to the ongoing drought crisis. But a recent state survey suggests Californians aren't yet heeding Governor Brown's call to conserve. State residents have reduced water use by just 5%, substantially less than the 20% Brown requested. And for Bay Area residents, the number is only 2%. Is voluntary conservation enough, especially if the drought continues into the next year? We'll talk about it next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. On the 17th of January, Governor Jerry Brown declared a state of emergency and requested a voluntary 20% cutback in water usage. Water use has declined throughout the state, but according to the State Water Board, only by 5%. Hot summer months are up ahead in this third drought year, and every part of the state remains in severe drought. Should rationing be mandatory, and what price penalties ought there to be for failure to comply? In this opening Forum Hour, we'll try to answer those questions as we take stock of the ongoing drought and what can be done about it. Joining us in studio is Peter Glick, president of the Pacific Institute. They're a nonpartisan research institute, and he's also the author of Bottled and Sold and editor of World's Water Series. Welcome, Peter Glick.
Morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. We'll also say good morning to Jeff Mount, who's also here with us in studio, senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California and emeritus professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at the University of California, Davis. Welcome, Jeff Mount.
Thank you.
Jeff, let me begin with you because there's a lot of confusion about the data here, and I know you've got your whole readout there in your computer, but I was reading National Geographic and they were saying San Francisco cut 8%, East Bay 3%, but San Jose is actually using more in the last quarter. How do we get a hold of these figures and actually make sense of them?
So the State Water Resources Control Board has compiled these figures. So anybody who wants to geek out on these can go online and download the Excel spreadsheet and look at it for themselves. The first thing that comes to mind when you look at it, I understand the reports. There was a big report in the LA Times this morning about how LA is not doing their job. The problem is we don't have the data. What we've got basically is water use through April. That's the only reliable data we have, and even that's incomplete. So when you look at the state board's numbers, we actually haven't seen we haven't got the information to be able to assess how much people are and are not using. We're getting some glimmers into it, and as you would expect, it's highly variable around the state. Places that plan for the drought well tend not to be reducing water very much, and those that are in dire straits tend to be reducing their water use more. But it's still early days.
Well, I was reading Harlan Kelly, the PUC, says we're saving and we're making up for lost time, but you take a closer look and it indicates otherwise, Peter Glick. I mean, they're saying 10% is being saved voluntary, and figures I was looking at saying maybe less than 1%.
I just think we're not yet. As bad as this drought is, and it's a bad drought, we're not taking it seriously enough. And we're not taking it seriously because our water agencies aren't giving us the advice that we need. They're not reaching out to customers and telling them how they can save water effectively and efficiently. We're hoping that next year is going to be an El Nino year and might be wet. We're getting mixed messages, and it's not an adequate response to, even in a normal year, serious problems with our water resources.
And I should say it was Paul Rogers in the Mercury News who gave that figure of less than 1%. But I'm using your language now, Peter. Profligate and inefficient. I mean, that kind of sums it up in many ways. But you also have said that it's not desperate. It's good. We're being complacent. We're not doing enough, but it's not desperate. Maybe north of Marin it's desperate, but maybe in agricultural areas it's desperate. But statewide, no.
Well, so it's a big state, and there are a lot of different people in a lot of different circumstances. And it's not desperate overall in the sense that we turn on our taps and water comes out. But it is increasingly desperate that we do something more rational than what we're doing. Our water policy is not sustainable. And I actually think this year there's some desperate things going on, especially with groundwater, that we had better address, that are really sending us in the wrong direction. And, you know, I'm not worried that one day my tap is going to run dry, but that's not true for everyone. It's not true for certain people in the agricultural community. It's not true for our ecosystems. It is sort of desperate for many different communities around the state.
I want to talk a little bit more about that desperation, not to use that word promiscuously or anything. But Jeff Mount, since we're mentioning groundwater here, they're at record low levels. The farmers are selling and buying, and there are all these water exchanges and water transfers going on. There's concern about all this. I mean, maybe should groundwater be regulated more? The effect on the aquifers is part of the concern?
I think there is consensus now, as close as I've ever seen in all the decades of working on water policy issues, that we need to regulate groundwater. We're the last state. We used to say thank God for Texas because they didn't regulate groundwater either, but now they do regulate groundwater. And what we've got is a unfolding, slowly unfolding train wreck, particularly in the Central Valley, the ultimate tragedy of the commons in the sense that because we don't regulate groundwater, we are spectacularly overdrafting it at this point. And at utterly unsustainable rates. I mean, today, NPR carried a very nice report today on what was happening in the Central Valley with groundwater drilling. It's reminiscent of a gold rush kind of mentality out there. This can't be sustainable one way or the other. We're going to bring it into balance. Either it gets too expensive to continue to lift that water tremendous distances to the surface, or the state steps in and compels people to start managing groundwater in a more sustainable way. Michael, I want to emphasize, and Peter will certainly agree with this, groundwater is our single most important drought reserve in California, but we don't manage it that way. We manage it instead as sort of our daily use, our seasonal use, and somehow we have to shift back to looking at groundwater as our drought reserve. And I think this is the year, and maybe Peter will agree with this, that this is the year where we're most focused on new legislation that might get at that problem.
Well, reuse of water is really what you're talking about, Peter. I mean, this is what I see in your reports out of the Pacific Institute.
Well, so we did a series of studies that we released a couple of weeks ago looking at four solutions, and I'd like to talk about those, but let me just add to Jeffrey's comment here. Groundwater is the critical issue right now. I actually agree that if there's any time that we might actually make progress on groundwater regulation, it's now. I don't know if we will, but we're in a race to the bottom. We're in a situation now where if you have $1 million, you can drill a groundwater well, and then you can pump as much water as you want and screw your neighbors. It doesn't matter what's happening to your neighbor's well because we don't regulate it, we don't monitor, we don't allocate it. Jeff's entirely right. This year might be an opportunity if the legislature can actually step up and pass some decent groundwater law. If they don't, it's just going to it is a slowly, although not so slowly, unfolding train wreck.
Well, we know a lot of legislators listen to forums, so out there, if you're listening and hearing what these two experts have to say, yeah, there's a real opportunity here. There's other opportunities, though. I mean, you've written a good deal about not only water reuse, as I said, but stormwater capture. I mean, there are things that can be done much to a greater extent.
So there are things that we've done in the past traditionally, which is build big dams and build big aqueducts to move water from one place to another and drill another groundwater well. And what we're arguing, and many other people have argued now for a while, is that those are tapped out. Those solutions aren't the solutions for the 21st century, but that there are solutions. We can improve the efficiency of our water use in the agricultural sector and the urban sector and cut our demand and do the things we want with less water. So those are two options. More stormwater capture and reuse and more wastewater reuse are two new supply options. And those four options have enormous potential that has partly been tapped statewide, but could be tapped much more effectively and much more aggressively than we're doing now.
Well, I was reading recently about the Getty Center. They turned off all their fountains and they were actually saving about 2,500 gallons a day. I mean, this is a kind of metaphor for what we can do, at least potentially, if we take stock of ways of conserving water. And yet the conservation, Jeff Mann, as Peter's been saying, it's not just coming across here the way Governor Brown had hoped it would. So are we looking toward mandatory? Is that really going to be necessary?
So the way to look at this is that the part of the reason we're not seeing so much conservation at this point, and again, I remind you, the data is incomplete at this point, is that some places have prepared very well. Let's take Southern California. After the drought of 87 to 92, where it was, we may all forget what a panic it was in Southern California in 92 when there was mandatory rationing and they were kind of caught flat-footed by that six-year-long drought. By the way, a reminder, we're in year three of our drought. They made $12 billion worth of investments in their water supply system and did a lot of what Peter's talking about. They did recycle, reuse, increase storm capture. They built a couple of very big dams down there to store water that principally they were getting from the north. And so when you're in Southern California, it doesn't feel like a drought. There's just no two ways around it. So a mandatory across-the-board 20% is unlikely to be realized anyways. I mean, it's a simple policy prescription to a very, very complicated problem. That said, there are other parts of the state where they are rationing very well, and they're cutting back very fast out of necessity. So Michael, I don't think you're going to see anything this year. And I tell you, though, if it's dry next year, we are going to have a very different conversation.
But what about this, I mentioned it in the billboard, this $5 million campaign, an ad campaign, Make It a Quickie, which brings other things to mind sometimes. But, you know, the San Francisco Water Agency out there campaigning and making people even more aware. Think it's going to have any desired effect, Peter?
Well, I have mixed feelings about that. I believe very strongly that public education and communications is a key part of this. The more we know about the seriousness of the problem and the options that are available to us, the more people are likely to take action. I do believe that in the long run, the solution is not shorter showers and brown lawns. That's deprivation. And when we talk about conservation and efficiency, what we talk about is doing what we want with less water. It's a shower with an efficient shower head. It's washing your clothes with efficient washing machines. It's getting rid of that lawn so it doesn't go brown. It's getting rid of it and replacing it with a beautiful garden that's water efficient but takes a lot less water than lawns. I think the day of the lawn should be over in California, but there's a
huge... But about half of the use of water is outdoors.
In residential use, in the use of our in water in our homes in California, around half, and in some places much more than half, of our water is outdoor landscaping, and it's primarily lawns. And that's a tremendous resource, if you will, that we could tap if we were a little more smart about the kinds of policies we put in place.
Well, and then you see these other statistics about agriculture using 80% of water, and you wonder why there isn't more drip irrigation or why we don't have, for that matter, precise irrigation, those kinds of things.
Well, yes, that was one of the four studies we just recently released, is looking at the ag side of this. And there's enormous potential in untapped potential in the urban areas, and there's enormous untapped potential in the agricultural community as well. Look, there's progress has been made in all of these sectors. We're already growing more food with less water. We're flushing our toilets with more efficient toilets. But there's still a lot of untapped potential. There's still 20% of our orchards statewide are irrigated with flood irrigation. Now, 80% are irrigated with sprinklers or precision drip. That's great. But there are 20% of our orchards alone, which could be moved to more efficient irrigation technologies and save a tremendous amount of water.
Jeff Mount.
Okay, so as in all things water, there are no black and white simple answers or silver bullet solutions. And one of the ones that comes up again and again, and Peter's been certainly knows this, is that orchard, the water that came off that orchard, that so-called excess water, goes back in the ground and recharges the groundwater, for example. In the Central Valley, the vast majority of groundwater recharge comes from agriculture. It also flows back into local ditches and streams and is picked up by farmers downstream. I do want to caution that the concept of efficiency in the agricultural sector, we have to be really careful about that because a gallon saved in one spot is actually a gallon deprived to somebody else. And right now, because we're in such deficit in the agricultural area, I mean, take for example that we're overdrafting 2.5 million, about 2 million acre feet per year. All that water, that so-called excess water, is currently used. Also, because both know I come from UC Davis, that are the home of technology and agriculture, there's been tremendous implementation of water use efficiency in the agricultural sector. And that new water, which is released by that efficiency, is picked up and used to grow more crops. So the challenge would be how to stop people from growing more crops based on that new efficiency. And therein lies a fundamental problem.
Peter Glick.
Yeah, I'd like to respond to that because Jeff is right in many ways, in the sense that not all inefficient use is obviously inefficient. But there are some really important points here. One is that I think the estimate of groundwater recharge from inefficient agricultural use is actually too large. I think that's not as much groundwater recharge as we think. I think a lot of that inefficient water evaporates off unproductively and can be captured. But in addition, if there's unintentional recharge from overuse of water, let's make it intentional. Let's figure out how to grow our crops more efficiently. And if we save water, one option, as Jeff noted, is farmers just put it to more use on a different piece of land. But why don't we put it to use intentionally recharging groundwater? You don't have to withdraw it. You don't have to apply it. It doesn't have a water quality problem if you apply it. It can be left in stream. There are lots of efficiency examples in the Central Valley that I think are not adequately being captured.
Jeff Mann.
So to finish this off, everything you say is conceptually true. I mean, it can be done. The reality, of course, is a much harder thing. That is absolutely prescribing that people leave that water there. But Peter, it translates to a simple solution. You have to fallow land. That efficiency over the long run means you have to ultimately fallow some land to get those yields that you want. That might be an option. In fact, one would argue if we continue where we're going, that's a future for agriculture.
If you've just joined us, we're talking about coping with the California record drought, and we'll bring you into this discussion. In fact, let me give out the number now. Our toll-free number is available to you, and we do welcome your involvement in the program. If you care to join us with questions or comments, you can do so now at 866-733-6786. Again, the number to call, and you're cordially invited to do so, is 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, and you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle @KQED Forum, or go to our Facebook page. I want to go to John Woodling, who is Executive Director of the Regional Water Authority, which represents the interests of over 20 water providers in the greater Sacramento area, and have him weigh in with us. John, good to have you aboard here. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning to you. And I guess I'd like to begin by bringing to the listeners' attention the fact that Governor Brown also put out an executive order. We keep talking about January 17th, but on April 25th, he asked the state to redouble the state drought actions. How are we doing on that score?
In our area, we're doing pretty well. We've been calling for customers to reduce their water use by 20% or more since about mid-January. And we looked at our data and really looked at February through May, and we're down about 18% in water use for that time period. So, you know, in the Sacramento region at least, the customers are stepping up and reducing water use.
And Folsom Lake, very low water, no?
Folsom Lake is better than it was. We were in very dire straits in January, early February, at historically low levels and historically low flows on the Lower American River. We did get, fortunately, a few storms. We have some storage in Folsom, but the concern now is where we end up at the end of this fall and what next winter's like.
What do you see in the way of possible emergency regulations from the State Water Board?
I suspect there will be probably some mandatory reporting. I think the State Board was not enthused about the response they got to their request for data. So I expect to see some mandatory reporting. I don't know what else to expect as far as prescriptive requirements, but it's important to put things in place that can be enforced if they're going to be of any value.
And at this point, some advice in terms of what you have brought forth with respect to successes for those who are perhaps not in that positive position?
Well, you know, it's a combination of things. First, we have done a lot more outreach this year to the customers. We have stepped up enforcement for a lot of agencies. So there are patrols and there are citations being issued. The thing that probably helped us the most was that very stark reality of the low levels at Folsom Lake and pretty much constant media attention in January and February of – you know, gold rush era towns that were exposed on the lake bed for the first time in more than 30 years. So, you know, I think that that very stark picture got a lot of attention here.
Again, John Woodling is Executive Director of the Regional Water Authority, which represents the interests of over 20 water providers in the greater Sacramento area. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And I want to go back, if I could, to policy with Jeff Mount and Peter Glick. There's a $34.2 billion energy and water funding bill that was approved by the Senate panel back on June 17th. And Senator Feinstein has said that this will help mitigate drought, but there's no earmarks for California projects. I mean, what do you foresee here, gentlemen? Is it really going to help, as Senator Feinstein believes, Peter Glick?
This is the federal bill?
Yeah, I'm looking at the federal bill exactly.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of...
There's also $100 million in this for Bureau of Reclamation. So, I mean, what do you foresee?
I don't foresee a lot of immediate response. I think they're looking at long-term solutions rather than short-term solutions. And I think what we need is some short-term state policy, especially on groundwater regulation, especially on water conservation and efficiency. There, as always in California, there's a big debate about what should we spend money on in the water area. And I think there's too much of a tradition of spending money on things that aren't actually going to produce effective, more efficient water use.
Well, here's a prediction. If we don't spend our revenue well and don't spend it efficiently, we're going to have ratepayer rates going up. We're going to have more water costs. We're going to also have more wildfires, and we're also going to have probably more suffering in the ecosystems. I'm sorry to put it so boldly, but
yeah,
that's right. That's how I see it. Mm-hmm. And let me bring our callers in here, and we'll start, Miriam, with you. Good morning.
Hi, yes. This is Miriam Gordon. I'm the California Director with Clean Water Action. Just a quick comment on the dialogue the two participants were having about agriculture and conservation in the context of the increasing salinity of groundwater. I think if we don't pursue conservation measures for irrigation, more and more of the groundwater supply is being eliminated basically by fertilizer use and the increasing salinity problem. But I wanted to ask Jeffrey and Peter to comment on the current situation in the legislature with the various bond measures. The governor has finally come out with his proposal and his perspective on what we should do about our water supply. And this is being debated in the legislature. There have been over 12 bills, I think, on the bond. What are your feelings about, the controversy between storage in surface water and groundwater and whether or not we should have continuous appropriation?
No, I'm glad you brought that up, Miriam. We were talking about the bond issues before we went on the air here. So let's have you weigh in. Peter Glick?
Yeah, so we don't yet know what bond measure, if any bond measure, is going to be on the ballot in the fall. There's a big $11 billion bond measure that's sort of a holdover from 4 years ago that everyone pretty much agrees isn't going to work, but they have to figure out how to replace it. And there's been, as Miriam notes, back and forth in the legislature, all different versions being discussed. And part of the problem is that in order to get a bond past the legislature, you need a two-thirds vote. And in order to get two-thirds vote, you sort of have to give a lot away to a lot of different interests. And so
These are just political tensions, really, aren't they?
Yeah, but that means that the bond has been getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And so what was originally thinking, well, $11 billion won't work, so we'll try and develop a $6 billion bond. And that's now grown to 10 or 11 again because they're trying to get votes.
Whoa, all right. On that score, we're going to a break here. But when we come back, we'll hear more from you. We're talking to Peter Glick, who is head of the Pacific Institute. And we're also talking to Jeff Mount, senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California. More of your calls and emails when we return on Forum. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and as Jeff Mount said earlier, we are in the third year of a drought here. Governor Brown asked for 20% conservation reduction of water use. We are not there. We probably aren't even a quarter of the way there. And Peter Glick is with us talking about water, as he often does, president of the Pacific Institute. They're a nonpartisan research institute, and he's also the author of Bottled and Sold and editor of World's Water Series. Jeff Mount is a senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California and emeritus professor of earth and planetary sciences at UC Berkeley. We also spoke with John Woodling, executive director of the Regional Water Authority, and we're going now to your calls and emails. And actually, Peter had a point, though, that he wanted to go to before we go to more calls and emails. Peter?
Yeah, just to follow up
on bond issues.
Yeah, on Miriam's call about the bond. We don't know whether there will be a bond on the ballot. We don't know how big it will be. We don't know whether the voters will go for it. But an important thing to remember is that no matter what, it's not going to help us with the short-term problems of the drought. Maybe if it provides infrastructure, new supply, more efficiency in the long run, it can help us. But do not look to the bond this fall as a solution to the current drought crisis.
Well, as we were saying during the break, Tina and I, we're going to have to do a whole hour just on policy and what's going on with the legislature with not only bond but groundwater. Mm-hmm. Skip writes, does coping include talking about California's population growth? Can the water supply support 60 million people in California? How many people can the freshwater supply support? I think that's a question that looms out there. And so do questions like these from listeners. Linda says, given that agriculture usage is 80% and individual usage is only 20%, why does it even matter what I do? If individual water use were reduced to zero, we'd still have a drought. Of course, zero is not possible. Any attainable reduction in individual use would just be a drop in the bucket, so to speak. And kind of dovetailing on that, Brian says, gosh, we've done this conversation many times, and the answer is so obvious, I must be misunderstanding something. The urban people have saved and conserved water magnificently. The farmers are still flooding the desert with precious water to grow monsoon crops and rice paddies. As long as big ag is insanely wasteful with our water, why should I bother only flushing when it's brown? Gentlemen, want to speak about this kind of divide? Because
sure.
It's a pretty serious one. As you can tell by the tone of some of these emails. Yeah, Jeff is laughing, but people are saying, ag's not doing enough here. Why should I be doing it?
All right, so Jeff's pointing at me. Okay, so first of all, in terms of the population question, we can support as many people as we want, depending on what we're willing to do with the water we have. We could have a lot of people if we didn't have any agriculture. We could have a lot of agriculture if we didn't care how much water people use. The question is, how are we going to allocate the water that we have? And that gets to the second set of questions. Yes, the urban areas have done reasonably well at improving conservation and efficiency measures, but so is agriculture. Agriculture, we're growing more food with less water. Agriculture's working on this problem too. And the truth is, there's potential in every sector of our economy to continue to do what we want with less water. There's still a lot of inefficient toilets and washing machines and dishwashers out there. There's still inefficient farms out there. You can't say this is only agriculture's problem or only the city's problem. We're a single state. We have a complex water system, and we all could be doing much better than we're doing.
As they like to say, we're all in this together. It takes a village and all that. Let me get some – there are so many great cliches and platitudes for talking about how we need to get these efforts together.
Yeah.
Let me get John on as our next caller. John, you're on. Hi.
Good morning, Michael and guests. In 2011, there was a study done or sponsored by the California Water Resources Board, which indicated that the per capita use for families was widely disparate. For instance, in San Francisco, we did pretty well, 47 gallons per day per family, while in other counties, for instance, Santa Clara and San Mateo County, the figures were double those in San Francisco. And if we go into Inyo County, the figures were astronomical, over 400 gallons per day. These figures indicate that we should not be looking just at conservation, but we should be looking at those counties which are actually wasting water and asking them to do much more than they are already.
Well, you got the spreadsheet, Jeff Mount. Respond to that.
So again, as in all things water, it's never as simple as that. The fact is, San Francisco does use much less than the, well. Let's take an example: Palm Springs versus San Francisco. there's a bunch of wealthy people in both places. So in San Francisco, who's got a lawn? Hardly anybody has a lawn. And remember, half the use is landscaping right off the bat. It's nice and cool here in San Francisco, and really hot out there. So you're going to see real big regional differences.
I thought let's talk a little bit about how money figures into this, because I'm looking at an email here. The drought is a prime example, Emma writes, of why private companies should not be in the water business. Water is a necessary resource, must be regulated in a way that is not compatible with the goals of commerce. Water companies don't make money if we are conserving water. Water should be completely owned by the people and managed by government on behalf of the people. Okay, now that we've got that editorial comment, I'm struck by the fact that supposedly a model for purchasing is in Hetch Hetchy. At least that's what I read. And I'm also reading that there's all kinds of money at stake here in terms of the goals or meeting the goals. Santa Clara, for example, in their water district, if they meet the 20% goal, they'll have about a $30 to $40 million loss in water sales.
Yeah.
And then let me just read another email here, because I think money does figure into this a lot. This is a listener named Jody who writes, please ask your guests to address how in Los Angeles in years past residents were asked to conserve in their water usage, and they did such a good job that the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power's revenue went down, and as a result they raised water rates, so people were using less but paying more. We expect the same to happen in the Bay Area if residential users are successful in reducing their water use?
So I'll address that, and Peter will probably add to it. So yeah, this is one of the issues that emerges in a drought like this. When you have basically tiered pricing for water and people actually conserve, the local water districts start running out of money, and you're punished basically for conserving water, and your rates have to go up and to keep the infrastructure going. So PPIC just did a really interesting report on this called Paying for Water in California, which you can download at the website there, that looks at this in infinite excruiting detail on what we're paying.
You say the website is the Public Policy Institute of California.
Yeah, PPIC.org, and you can download that report there. Ellen Hanick is the senior author on that. It's really useful as a guide to what it costs. And one of the proposals in there is to switch over to drought pricing, so that we actually do change the way we price water during droughts, so that we don't get a situation where everybody does such a great job of conserving, you can no longer pay for the infrastructure necessary to deliver the water. And that's a significant problem in some districts in California. But again, these are the kinds of things that are going to take changes in policy and adjustment along the way. Not that hard to do, but certainly necessary.
And we'll bring in another caller, and that's Charlie. You're on. Good morning.
Hi, can you hear me?
Can hear you fine.
I'm a landscape designer and an avid fly fisherman in Northern California, and I was concerned. I've been working on Spring Creeks in Northern California, and I've noticed the pH has been significantly rising, and a lot of people are puzzled as to why, possibly indicative of the aquifer level dropping, I guess, and the nutrient levels increasing. And also wanted to address the increased wild rice and rice growth in central and northern California. I'll take my answer offline.
Okay. Thank you for the call. Peter Glick.
No, Jeff, go ahead.
So,
We've been monitoring
UC Davis, the watershed center there, has been monitoring spring-fed systems throughout California for quite some time.
Monitoring the pH?
Yeah, monitoring all aspects of water quality and wildlife within them. And the really, really big aquifer-driven systems, like some that come off Mount Shasta and places like that, we're not seeing much of a difference right now, and that's because it takes a really long time to have an effect. But the smaller springs, guys, observation is correct. We are seeing increases in pH in some of them and reductions in flows, and that's associated with the drought and overuse of the groundwater sources for those springs. So that's an important issue. But I want to come to rice, because everybody points the finger at rice, and rice uses a fair amount of water. But remember, there are multiple benefits with rice. Now, I'm not an apologist for rice. Rice is a big water user, and they're going to fallow tens of thousands of acres of rice in the Sacramento this year. But there are these ancillary costs that we don't think about, and that's the forgotten part of this drought, which is the ecosystem and wildlife. And it turns out those rice does rice farms, are incredibly important for the Pacific Flyway. So ducks and a variety of migratory waterfowl use them extensively. And that's why there's no simple black and white answer here. We've got to cut agriculture. Well, there's going to be some other costs associated with that for things we actually place value in. And that's actually Peter and I were offline talking about this. We're really not talking enough about what's happening to the ecosystems in California in this drought.
Yeah.
And the fact is, we ignore them now. We pay the costs for, in some cases, decades in the future. And I really honestly feel, looking out over the landscape that's going on right now, it seems to have just dropped off the radar in terms of discussions over the drought.
Another program we're going to have to do just to devote to. Let me get some more callers on, though. Kathy, thanks for waiting. You're on with us. Hi.
Hi, Michael. This is Kathy. Got a quick question related to water use that affects agriculture but also residential users. I haven't heard anything about a state move to require metering from all water companies, and it seems like there's some very big water users, like Sacramento water system doesn't even use metering. Can your callers address that?
Peter.
Sure. So that's a great question. Jeff made this point earlier. We don't adequately monitor and measure all sorts of aspects of our water use. The state, however, has addressed the metering question for cities. There is now a requirement, weak though it may be, that all residential urban water use be metered by 2025. And some of the cities are doing it a little bit faster. Sacramento has historically not been metered. They're moving toward metering very slowly and expensively, but they are moving toward metering. And Kathy's basic point is right, that when we meter water use goes down because you can charge appropriately for it. You understand what you're using. So that's an important point. It's an important aspect of moving toward more efficient use. But we don't meter groundwater use. We don't meter some very critical uses in California. And if there's going to be groundwater reform, one piece of that is going to have to be more accurate metering and reporting of use.
More of your emails. Let me read Nick's email to us. He writes, I think lawns should be made illegal. They are a massive waste of water, serve no purpose other than the aesthetic. At least in Southern California, an area that is largely a desert, all landscaping should be limited to plants which are native to that particular part of the state. And Stacy writes, why isn't the state or local water municipalities promoting gray water systems by tax credits or other programs? I hate the fact that I use potable water in my toilets and that my shower tub water can't be used to water my lawn instead of potable water, but I also don't have a huge budget to install a gray water system myself. And Hillary asks, Peter Glick just mentioned intentional groundwater recharge through agricultural practices. How does that impact water quality if irrigation water is laced with pesticides and herbicides? Does that not exacerbate a drinking water quality problem in these areas?
Yeah. So, in fact, the idea would be that you improve the efficiency of water use in agriculture. You grow more food with less water. And what you're doing is you're using that saved water not on some additional piece of land to grow more food, but for intentional groundwater recharge. So it's not contaminated groundwater. You don't want to, of course, contaminate our groundwater with agricultural chemicals, but that's sort of what we're doing now with inefficient use. We put too much water on a piece of land, and it becomes laced with agricultural chemicals, and that accidentally or unintentionally recharges groundwater. We want to get away from that. So we want more intentional groundwater recharge with some of the more pristine waters that are available to us. And I think we're beginning to see movement in that direction, but there should be much, much more of that.
Here's Sonia who writes, I live in Marin and I've been trying to get a gray water laundry to landscape system installed. The county does have workshops on this to inform people about gray water, but try to find installers. I've been trying for a year. I get referrals, example from Graywater Action, but no one ever comes through. Wouldn't it serve us better if the water district actually trained installers?
On Graywater, we're undergoing a quiet revolution on Graywater. Just a decade ago, it was absolutely taboo to even discuss the notion of using Graywater in your garden, and now we're shifting in that direction. So in many cases, this is going to be a market driven process. Eventually, a lot of people are going to want to start having gray water systems, and the capacity to install them will begin to appear. There still needs to be a little bit of help on policy to help gray water along, but I think we're at sort of the beginning of a slowly unfolding revolution in the use of gray water.
I think that's an interesting point, that the 21st century solutions are going to require some new jobs and new thinking and new training and new incentives. And the fact that it's hard now to find a good installer for gray water systems in some places is an indication of a need. And I think Jeff's right that there is a revolution going on, but it's a slow one and it needs to be speeded up.
And some more email comments from listeners, actually, and web postings. Let me just get these on the air here. Kim writes, I've seen water without restraint used to clean the streets here in San Francisco that have been soiled with human waste the night before. It's a lot of water used, but the streets have to be cleaned. Otherwise, the pungent smell is just overwhelming, particularly in the midst of warm summer afternoons. And Gabrielle says, I'm a resident of Napa where hotels are springing up weekly, and I wonder how residents versus tourists are expected to conserve water when tourists and hotels cannot be forced to heed the call. Again, we get into all of these kind of nuances of policy. Erling writes, I lived in Windhoek, Namibia in the late 60s and early 70s. Water was recycled completely. Namibia is essentially a desert. Everyone is made aware of the importance of not wasting water. Why can't water be recycled here? And here again, whenever we have this discussion about policy, desalination comes up. Joe says, desalination is not the solution of our water problems. Desalination requires tremendous amounts of energy. The primary source of our energy is carbon-based, which increases the CO2 levels in the atmosphere. Increased CO2 levels increases warming, climate change, and ocean acidification. There are no easy solutions. We have to learn to live within our water supplies by either limiting population, industrialization, and agriculture, and learn to drastically conserve.
Yeah, can I make a comment about one of those comments? Windhoek, Namibia, the capital of Namibia, for many, many years, really for decades, has been using reclaimed water, high-quality reclaimed water, and reusing it. They capture their wastewater, they treat it to a pretty high standard, and they reuse it. We're doing that now in California, and Orange County has a very sophisticated water reuse recycling system. And one of the solutions that we identified in these studies that we put out a couple of weeks ago is expanded use of recycled water. The truth is we collect a lot of wastewater. We treat it to a pretty good standard and we throw it away. And there's millions of acre feet of water that could be put to some sort of use, up to and including potable reuse if we want it. We can treat water to potable standard like Windhoek, Namibia. And I think that's a part of our future. That's a source of supply that we've ignored for a long time.
Bring in another caller. That's you, Joe. Welcome. Thanks for waiting.
Hey, good morning. I have a quick question about whether this conversation has happened on the national level at all. I just returned from a trip to Eastern Washington where it was pouring rain for 2 days and just thought that that was a resource that they have that if they were able to share with our agricultural part of the state, we might be able to eliminate some of the drought concerns.
Now, how much is that happening on the national level, Peter, the kind of discussion he's talking about here, or is it?
Well, there is a big conversation, a growing conversation about water worldwide, not just in the West, not just in the U.S. But the idea of transferring water very large distances is, you know, we do move water around. It's expensive to do that. We move water from the north of Northern California to Southern California.
We use more fossil fuels to do it.
It's an energy-intensive thing, and there are limits. We're not going to be moving water from the Missouri or the Mississippi or the Pacific Northwest down to California because the cost of doing so is prohibitive compared to the cost of doing some of these things that we've already been talking about today. Conservation and efficiency is cheaper. Wastewater reuse and stormwater capture is cheaper. There are things that we need to do locally that are far less expensive than moving water from ever-increasing distances. And, of course, we now have a better understanding, as Jeff has noted, of the ecosystem impacts of taking water from one place and moving it to another. We used to ignore those impacts, but we can't any longer.
Let me read a couple more emails here. Jessica writes, the market has a very effective mechanism, pricing. As we've seen with oil and gas, price increases change people's and even businesses' behavior, including investing in efficient operations. Why does this not seem to be on the table? And Bell writes to us, it's unbelievable to me that everyone sidesteps any discussion of the huge amount of water being used and wasted in animal agriculture. A wonderful documentary was just produced called Cowspiracy that outlines all the ways no environmental groups will address this huge waste of water. What we need to do is cut down on or stop altogether eating meat. A cow drinks 40 gallons of water a day, for example. We use most of our water growing soy and corn to feed to livestock. It takes 2,000 gallons of water to make 1 pound of hamburger. Michelle writes, I live in Sacramento and know how much we have to cut very drastically. We just spent a week in Oroville where we observed the RV resort watering the little patches of grass for the RVs to park on nonstop all day long, even with heat over 100 degrees. The message is not out in the rest of the state. And Melanie sends in a correction here. I live in Sacramento and would like to provide clarity that meters have been installed in the downtown neighborhoods of Curtis Park and Midtown, and metering will be in effect by 2015, not 2025, as your guest said. As an aside, I also agree lawns should be illegal. We'll go to more of your calls. Let me go next to Harvey in Berkeley. Hi, Harvey. You're on.
Hi, Michael, and hello, Jeff and Peter. Thank you very much for all that you do. It's so important. I have two recommendations to preserve California's freshwater resources. One is because of the drought and overpumping of our freshwater aquifers, we have serious saltwater intrusion. And the problem with that is that there have been fracking offshore in the Santa Barbara Channel, and a lot of the toxic chemicals they use could leak. It could enter the saltwater intrusion and mix with our freshwater aquifers. And second, Fukushima has been dumping 300 tons of radioactive water into the ocean every day. If we have if we experience the big one, a major megathrust earthquake like Fukushima, and Diablo Canyon goes down, we'll have an endless flow of radioactive water entering our oceans, and that'll be radioactive saltwater intrusion into our freshwater aquifers. So I say close Diablo down as fast as we can if we want to preserve our freshwater resources.
Jeff Mon is having a strong response to your comments.
Okay, so right now there is no indication that the fracking that's gone on in the Santa Barbara Basin is affecting local groundwater. And I remind you, if it's saline, we don't pump it. Because you can't use it, and it's too expensive to treat it. Although that's going to change, I think, as over time. On the Fukushima side, we still haven't seen Fukushima show up here in our waters in any significant way, other than the trash that was associated with, or the debris that was associated with the earthquake itself. But I do understand the concern of Diablo Canyon to people, since it is along a very active segment of the San Andreas system.
Yeah, Peter Glick.
Yeah, I'll add to that. There are worries about fracking, of course, and certainly in other parts of the country, it's been a really serious local problem. And there are water-related risks of fracking. We don't do much fracking yet in California. We do some, but it's potentially going to grow. And the state is conducting a series of studies right now to try and understand a little bit better what the water-related risks are in terms of quantity, in terms of quality.
Excuse me, Peter. I've had people on this show speak with alarm about the possible effect on groundwater.
Yeah, so they're depending on what the state chooses to do in terms of expansion of oil and gas production, there are serious potential risks for groundwater, and it's certainly an issue that we ought to pay attention to.
We have been, and we will more, again, focusing on fracking as time goes on. I want to focus on a web comment here by a listener of ours named Doug. He writes, my grandfather worked on the California Aqueduct, designed the Yuma, Denver, and Eastern Washington agricultural water delivery systems, and obviously understood the issues when, more than 50 years ago, he thought all these systems should become buried, or at least covered systems, and talked about the change of agriculture from trees to dry weather crops. Why, if this discussion has been going on since the development of our main water trunk, has there not been change?
I can address some of that. As we know, evaporation off the surface of reservoirs is a significant loss of water, and this is particularly true in the Colorado system, where they have monitored it very closely. When you think of Lake Mead, it's a tremendous loss. Here in California, you know, the Department of Water Resources has looked at the California Aqueduct, for example, and the losses that occur, and it turned out they're pretty small. And we're actually not sure why they're small, but here's the simplest way to put it. Is it economic? Does it make economic sense to make that kind of investment, which would be very expensive? Or would it be cheaper to do what Peter says to do? You know, find other sources or other ways to save water. And I think it's cheaper to do what Peter says rather than covering these aqueducts. It's going to be cheaper in the long run. And that's ultimately what it comes down to. In all these decisions, we have to be careful to couch everything we're talking about in cost. If it's non-economic, it doesn't make sense.
Cost, and as you both have been implying, unintended consequences, as much as we can foresee what those are. Nicole writes, what about the difference between water usage in counties? Let's all be held accountable. For instance, places like Hillsborough, Palm Springs, these are places that are wasting water.
Yeah, so we've touched on that a little bit. Jeff talked about there's a big difference in climate. There's a difference in outdoor landscaping. There is a big difference in water use per person in different counties, and that highlights to some degree where we might put a little more effort. Obviously, if we're going to deal with landscaping, you don't want to necessarily do it in San Francisco. You want to work on landscaping and cutting landscaping water use in the Central Valley and the southern, you know, the southern desert areas where there's still a tremendous amount of lost water to outdoor use. So do the things that make sense economically and ecologically in the right places. It's a big state.
Are there more possibilities, though, Peter? I mean, we talked about mandatory, but just for incentives and disincentives with respect to water reduction that we're not looking at.
Oh, absolutely. So Las Vegas, I'm not a big fan of Las Vegas's conservation, water conservation programs. I think they could be doing much more. But many years ago, they implemented something called a cash for grass program, where they would pay people to remove landscaping and replace it with more efficient landscaping, remove lawns, put in nice gardens. And they removed quite a bit of lawn that way. Los Angeles now has sort of a cash for grass program. We could extend that kind of program, that kind of incentive, much more widely. And there ought to be more money for rebates for efficient appliances. There ought to be more money for farmers up front to change their irrigation system. Many of them want to be more efficient, but have trouble finding the capital to put in these more efficient systems. So their incentives, their financial opportunities, their educational opportunities, their new regulations, there are lots of policies that could capture a lot of these inefficient uses still.
And what about storage? We need more storage.
I was so hoping we'd avoid that conversation. That's probably for another session.
I love to talk about storage.
I love to talk about storage. Let's be clear.
Well, we're in this for the long haul.
We are in this, and this is one of the issues that's being addressed, maybe addressed by the bond. Although the amount of money they're proposing in the bond is not going to make much of a difference on the storage side. People are going to have to come up with ways to pay for it. So you got surface storage and you got groundwater storage, and as you know, in terms of surface storage that we have today, it's actually dwarfed by the availability of groundwater storage, potential groundwater storage. Which is much, much larger. And surface storage makes sense as long as you're willing to pay for it. And that's going to be the debate that we shift into over the long term on surface storage. Additionally, and at UC Davis, we looked at this, and at PPIC, we looked at this very closely. New surface storage, more storage does not translate to a lot more water. And when we've looked at it closely, when you look at the economics of it, you know, for every million acre feet of storage that you do, you get about 10% of that in actual and average annual yield. So we must be careful that storage is not viewed as a silver bullet solution to future droughts.
Good way to end, because we have to end, and I have to remind listeners that you can actually read about how Australians dealt with their 9-year drought and what Californians could draw from that experience. KQED's science editor Craig Miller's story and all our ongoing drought coverage is at kqed.org/science. Thanks, Jeff Maub. Thanks, Peter Glick.
Thank you.
And thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Another hour of Forum ahead. We're going to try to deconstruct the recent Supreme Court decisions and look at the term and what has gone on vis-a-vis the Supreme Court. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from David Marks. We remind you, you can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, and you can continue this discussion by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. Forum senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.